It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up on Central Time, 150 years of history gets a unique perspective from an amazing collection of clothing from one Wisconsin family. First, President-elect Donald Trump announced over the weekend that he plans to shut down his charitable foundation. The president-elect didn't say when he plans to pull the plug on the Trump Foundation, and there will be some hurdles to doing so anytime soon. New York's attorney general is currently investigating the Trump Foundation after allegations that it used charity money toward Trump's for-profit businesses. David Farenthold joins us now. He's a reporter for The Washington Post. He's been covering the controversy surrounding the Trump Foundation. David, welcome back.
Oh, thank you for having me on.
Well, what reasons, David, did Trump give for shutting down his charity?
He didn't really give a lot of reasons. I think the main reason was that he's trying to reduce his conflicts of interest now, reduce the ways in which he could sort of be seen to be taking money or being influenced by outsiders. This, among all his many business dealings, his business entanglements, this is one of the easiest entanglements to get out of, and so maybe that's why he's doing it first.
But maybe not so easy to get out of, according to the New York Attorney General. They've been investigating there. First of all, what is the foundation under investigation for by New York's Attorney General?
It's under investigation for a couple of things, but the main thing is violations of what's called the self-dealing rule. One of the basic laws of charity is you can't take money in the charity and use it to buy things for the person who runs the charity or for that person's businesses. And Trump appears to have done that on a number of occasions. He used money for charity to buy two large and very expensive portraits of himself, one of which was later hung up in a sports bar he owns. And he used the money in the charity to pay off business debts, obligations incurred in legal settlements by two of his businesses to the tune of $258,000.
So the attorney general in New York saying, I guess, you can't shut down the Trump Foundation while you're still under investigation. Is that right?
That's right. I mean, you can understand the reasons why. You wouldn't want to let people just give people a get out of jail free card if they shut down their foundation to get out of this scrutiny. So Trump has admitted that his Trump Foundation violated the self-dealing rules, but he hasn't told the New York AG exactly what violations he's admitting to, which instances he's talking about. He hasn't paid the penalty taxes that would come with that kind of admission. There's a lot of documents that the New York AG is trying to get. So until those things are in, until the New York AG sort of makes a determination about what punishment, if any, is warranted, he can't legally shut the foundation down.
Do we have an idea what kind of punishment is usually given out in a case of a self-dealing through a foundation like this?
Sure. Well, the IRS sets sort of penalty taxes. Usually it's 10 or 20% of the value of the self-dealing transaction. So Trump would have to pay the foundation back, first of all the money that it spent to help him in violation of that law. And then he personally would have to pay an additional penalty tax worth 10 or 20% of the value of the self-dealing transaction.
So Trump himself, Donald Trump himself says, okay, gonna shut this down sometime. The New York Attorney General says, put on the brakes, we're still investigating. Have we heard back from Donald Trump or his people since we heard that from the Attorney General there?
No, we haven't. Trump, I don't think, it seemed like from the original announcement that Trump maybe did not know that he could not just shut it down. What he was saying on Saturday was, I plan to shut it down. There was no indication in that announcement that there might be this wrinkle. I think maybe he just didn't know.
Talking to David Farenthold from the Washington Post, looking at the Trump Foundation, Donald Trump said over the weekend he would start working toward shutting that down to avoid conflicts of interest, but it's under investigation, as we're hearing in New York. Now, David, you've been reporting on the Trump Foundation and Donald Trump's charitable giving for some time now. Can you give us a Trump Foundation 101? What is it? Who runs it? What does it do?
Well, it's a very small foundation for somebody who's a billionaire. It only has about $1 million in the bank, according to the last tax filing. It's only ever had, at most, about $5 million in the bank. He started it in the late 80s to give away the money that he earned from the book, The Art of the Deal. But what's interesting is in the last few years, going back to 2008, Trump stopped giving his own foundation any of his own money. Instead, he had other people donate to his foundation, largely Vince and Linda McMahon, the wrestling moguls. And as you know, Linda McMahon is now Trump's nominee to be the Small Business Administration secretary. The McMahons put a bunch of money in, and that allowed Trump's foundation to keep going, basically at no cost to Trump himself. So Trump would use this foundation to give charitable donations, often to people who were under the impression, wow, I'm getting Donald Trump's money, when it really was not. So in the last few years, it's been giving away mostly other people's money, and it's often been, as we've talked about, violating these federal laws, federal rules about what you can do with the money. Often he's used it to benefit himself.
And there was one issue, at least one issue, of a political contribution made by the Trump Foundation. Can you talk about that?
That's right. The Attorney General of Florida, Pam Bondi, who is a big Trump supporter, this was a few years ago, she was considering, or her office was considering, whether to join an existing lawsuit by the New York AG against Trump University. This is when Trump University was still going on, was being accused of defrauding its customers by not giving them the services they were paying for. So Pam Bondi, the Florida Attorney General, was deciding, or her office was deciding, whether to join this existing lawsuit. At that same time, around the same time, the Trump Foundation gave a $25,000 gift to a political committee supporting Pam Bondi's reelection. Now, that's against the law. Charities are not allowed to give political gifts. So after we discovered this year and wrote about it earlier in May, the Trump Foundation admitted to the IRS it had done this, and Trump paid the money back, the $25,000, and also paid a $2,500, a 10% penalty tax.
Now we're in a situation, obviously, where Donald Trump is on his way into the White House, and the concerns here are about potential conflict of interest. Will donations to a Trump Foundation be seen as trying to get political favor? And this isn't the only one. One of Donald Trump's sons has been in a kerfluffle over his foundation, too.
That's right. Both the Trump sons were involved in things in the last couple of weeks that sort of show you to the degree to which the Trump family either did not anticipate winning or has taken made no sort of preparations to eliminate these conflicts of interest. So there was one instance in which the Eric Trump Foundation, run by Trump's second oldest son, was auctioning off a coffee with Ivanka Trump, his sister, this very important advisor to Donald Trump. You could have coffee with Ivanka Trump for people were bidding like $70,000 to have coffee with Ivanka Trump. And they were doing it, obviously, as a way of influencing the president-elect. So after some publicity, mostly from the New York Times, the Eric Trump Foundation shut down that auction. And then Eric Trump said that he would, in fact, shut down his entire charity or suspend it for the duration of his father's presidency. At the same time, both Eric and Donald Trump Jr. were listed as honorary co-chairmen and of a particular inauguration event, a post-inauguration event, at which donors to this very shadowy, not well-defined, nonprofit. If you gave $1 million to this nonprofit, you could have a personal meeting with Donald Trump. So this nonprofit that Eric and Donald Jr. were supposedly associated with was literally auctioning off the president's time. He'd be the president at that point. They were auctioning off some period of the president's time for $1 million. After some publicity from the Center for Public Integrity, that event was the appearance of Donald Trump at that event was canceled. Eric and Donald Trump Jr. said that they had nothing to do with it and tried to back away from it.
And then one of those, the Eric Trump Foundation, is going to go out of operation. Is that right?
Yes. What Eric Trump told me was that he's going to suspend the operations of the Eric Trump Foundation. So he'll stop raising money. He'll stop spending money. He won't shut it down because it will resume on the other side of the Trump presidency.
And you or someone at the Post had suggested he could just remove himself from that, right? And it didn't seem as though he'd considered that option.
That was a really mind-bending thing because, yes, it just shows you the degree to which they have not prepared to answer these questions at all. Eric Trump told me, well, I'm going to shut down or suspend my foundation for the duration of the presidency. And I said, well, why don't you just step away? You know, call it the, you know, Manhattan Foundation for St. Jude's, because most of what it does is pass money on to St. Jude's Hospital in Memphis. Call it something else. You step away from it. Let somebody else run it. So it's not, you know, you can keep the charity going. People won't see it, though, as a conduit to influence the First Family. Eric seemed like he hadn't even thought about that. He was like, oh, that's a good idea. I'll think about that. That's where they are in this process. It's kind of amazing.
We'll leave it there, David, and probably talk to you about these issues again in the future. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Washington Post reporter David Farenthold. He's been covering the Trump Foundation. He talked to us about President-elect Donald Trump's announcement that he would shut his charitable foundation down. We probably all have an item or two of clothing that's maybe 20 years old, maybe older. Well, imagine discovering that the attic of your family home not only had a bunch of old clothes, but well-preserved garments that tell the story of 150 years of history through fashion. That's what Jane Bradbury found when she visited her aunt in Marshfield, Wisconsin. Jane's aunt Augusta was the guardian of not only that treasure trove of clothing, but letters, receipts, and more that actually put those items in their historical context. The story of those clothes and gorgeous photos of them as well are featured in the book that she co-authored. It's called American Style and Spirit, Fashion and Lives of the Roddice Family, 1850 to 1995. Jane, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you for having me, Rob.
Well, walk us through the door. The first time you saw this collection in person, you were visiting your aunt in Marshfield at age 19, I think. What did you see?
Well, first of all, I used to go there every year as a child, so I knew the house very well, and the house was like a time capsule. If you'd gone there in 1914 and you went back in 2011, it didn't change. So when I was 19, I was brought up to the attic by my aunt, and she took down this big brown box, and she took out this black velvet dress that had been bought in Paris in 1880, and she beckoned me to try it on. And I recognized the dress because I'd seen it in photographs of my great aunt Jenny. So I put it on, and as soon as I felt those whale bones against my ribs and the high lace neck, I just felt like a different person. It affected my posture. It affected the way I walked because there was a long train attached to it. And I just felt that I was a different me. I felt sort of transformed.
When did you realize how historically important this amazing 150-year collection was?
Well, from that time, I knew that there were a lot of clothes there, but I had no idea to the extent. And I went back every year, and as she got older, I started to help my sister start doing some sorting about what was in the house. So I saw a bit more. I saw 50s dresses and hats, and I was familiar with some of the 19th century dresses that she had shown me, like that black dress. But then at about the time after she died, I decided I needed to really see what was there. And so I found a costume historian and conservator called Edward Mader, who had restored some of her dresses decades before, and I asked him to come and help me. So just after she died, we started to go through the clothes one by one. We labeled them with numbers and it gave a rough date and photographed them. And I was amazed because I knew there were lots of clothes, but I didn't realize that there were clothes from every decade of the 20th century. It was remarkable. At the same time, I discovered some old satchels filled with letters. So I would carefully pull some out, and they were from the 1890s. And the satchel also had things like menus from men's clubs from the 1890s. So at that point, I knew that there was an incredible amount in that house waiting to tell its stories.
And your Aunt Augusta was continuing a family tradition, but what made her so devoted to keeping not just the clothing, but as you say, the letters and the photos and everything else?
Well, I think it was a combination of reasons. I mean, many of us keep clothes because they're associated with people that we loved, or special events like a junior prom or a wedding or a special trip on the Queen Mary in their case. But also she had tremendous reverence for her relatives. She admired them very much. And so she didn't have the heart to throw those things away. The same for the letters. She once said or wrote somewhere that for her to throw away a letter would be to throw away a part of a person, and she just couldn't do that. So she was the ultimate hoarder, I guess you would say. She just kept everything. There were about 10,000 letters in the house.
I don't know. I think of a hoarder as not really having rhyme or reason, and she really had a reason, didn't she?
Yes. I think the other reason was that she and her mother were fascinated by history, and they realized that those clothes not only held memories of the family members or special events, but they held memories of America in the past. They were historical records of changing fashions, of the incredible ability of seamstresses to sew and embroider. So they were there to bring back America's past, not only their family's past.
We're talking to Jane Bradbury about her book. She's co-authored American Style and Spirit, Fashion and Lives of the Roddice Family, 1850 to 1995. Amazing story of a collection of clothing that a family preserved in Marshfield for 150 years. Jane, let's talk about the income level here. I learned again in the book, there aren't many collections that span time like this one. Usually when we have them, it's a very, very wealthy family. This is a middle-class kind of up-and-coming family over the years. Is that part of what makes this really unique?
Yes, it absolutely is. And when I found the Henry Ford Museum where I did donate the collection, they were thrilled because they wanted a collection that was from a middle-class family. They had couture clothes, as many museums do, and they also had some everyday clothes, but they didn't have clothes from this middle section, and certainly nothing that was as heavily documented as these clothes were.
And if I've seen collections like these, it was maybe from the White House or a New York City family. This is in the middle of Wisconsin, an hours-long train ride even from Milwaukee in the early days of Marshfield. Can you talk about the place here a little bit?
Absolutely. So it was quite a small town, but an up-and-coming town in the 1890s. And my great-grandmother, who was originally from New Jersey and moved to Milwaukee to teach school, fell in love with my great-grandfather. And then she inherited some money, and instead of using it to fix up their house or whatever, she encouraged him to use it to buy his own business. And he'd heard about this failing veneer company in the small town of Marshfield, which at that time was, as you say, it was 8 hours away by train. And whereas Milwaukee had some 200,000 or 20,000 inhabitants, Marshfield only had about 5,000. So they just got up from Milwaukee and went to that small town that didn't have very many amenities, and he took over the management of this failing company. And he acted as a hard-working entrepreneur, and he turned it over and eventually turned it into a world-class company that sold in Europe and across America. His son then took it over and expanded it even more.
And your aunt taught about the early days of Marshfield, and the word rough seems to come up a lot. This clothing, they had to protect from the mud. They would walk around, I understand, with boards to put across the mud puddles as they were walking around.
Oh, right. So the streets would not have been paved until about the late teens. And there's a photograph in the book of the outside of the house, and it's just a dirt path, really. And horse and carts. The land had been heavily wooded, but a lot of it had been cut down. And my great-grandmother reputedly said when she got there, "There are more stumps than people." And she was quite a sophisticated person, so this was quite a change for her. But she and other women who had moved to that rough, small town, they got together and started a women's club one of them would read Shakespeare plays together, and they would dress up in outfits like Shakespearean heroines. And they had another club called the Ladies Travel Class. And the travel was completely mental. They got together and they studied different parts of the world, Spain, Portugal, Scandinavian countries, and America itself. And they were very serious, hardworking, and gave each other reports to keep their minds going.
I want to talk just a bit about the fashion itself, which I haven't brought up yet. Looking at the pictures of the clothing and, in many cases, of people wearing them in their original use, It's amazing how many things have changed, and yet some of the old clothing, I could see somebody wearing somebody like something like that now, maybe at a wedding, maybe even in casual company. What do you make of the changes in fashion that you see here?
Absolutely. Fashion does have a way of changing and then coming back on itself. And I think certainly some of the 1930s dresses that you'll see in the exhibition, mm-hmm. the Henry Ford, and in the book, could be worn absolutely today. In fact, I would be delighted to have them in my wardrobe because they are very... The 30s was a time when they were really quite very modern, very minimalist in a way, but very elegant. The way they would use the bias cut to fit the body. One of them, which is probably homemade by my grandmother during the Depression, using a McCall's pattern, that's very much influenced by Hollywood, very glamorous with sort of draperies coming on the back. And also some of the 1950s dresses you could absolutely wear today. Fitted lace dresses with lovely necklines. You could wear them today and get some very good remarks, I think.
But I'm looking at a pair of 1950 men's shoes that I would happily wear too. Jane, thank you so much. It's been a lot of fun. It's an amazing collection.
Thank you for having me.
That was Jane Bradbury. She's the co-author of American Style and Spirit, Fashion and Lives of the Roddice Family, 1850 to 1995, which tells the story of her family's amazing collection of clothing. It's currently on display at the Henry Ford Museum in Dearborn, Michigan. Some parts of that are coming to Wisconsin, too. You can see a slideshow of some of the garments and of Aunt Augusta on the Central Time Facebook page and over at WPR.org. Here's a saying you might have heard before, walk a mile in their shoes, or words to that effect. It's something that parents and teachers often tell young boys and girls to consider before they judge or make decisions that affect the lives of other people, to reinforce the idea of empathy. But our next guest says emotional empathy is overrated. In his new book, he says that empathy might actually make us well-intentioned, but also cause us to make decisions with bad long-term consequences. Paul Bloom joins us now. He's the Brooks and Susan Reagan Professor of Psychology at Yale University. His new book is called Against Empathy, The Case for Rational Compassion. Paul, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, this is something that's going to get, I think, an instant reaction from people. You've probably heard it yourself. What do people say when you tell them you're writing a whole book against the idea of empathy?
It's kind of like writing a book against kittens or against world peace. But what I immediately do is I explain what I mean by empathy, because people mean different things by it. And sometimes people mean empathy just to mean everything good, and I'm not against that. But what I am against is empathy in the sense of putting yourself in another person's shoes and feeling what they feel, feeling their pain, feeling their suffering. A lot of people think this is a good thing, and it certainly feels good when we do it. But it turns out that this sort of empathy is very biased. We feel it more to people of our ethnicity, of our race, of our country. And it's also innumerate. It leads us to focus on the one rather than the many. And when we think hard about it, we realize that we're at our best when we don't think empathically, but we use more calculated cost-benefit reasoning.
And you use the phrase at some point, emotional empathy, to narrow down a little bit what you're talking about, this idea that we are trying to feel what someone else is feeling.
That's exactly right. So I distinguish it from cognitive empathy, which is understanding other people. I'm not against that, although understanding other people is neither good nor bad. It's an amoral tool. So if you're a good person, understanding other people will make you able to behave nicer to them and help them. If you're a psychopath or seducer or con man or torturer, understanding other people will make it easier for you to make them suffer.
And let's talk about other big-time, potentially bad effects of emotional empathy. One argument that people often give in favor of this kind of empathy is, well, if we could identify with another person's feelings, we'd be less likely to do them harm. But you say the way it often plays out in the world is by over-identifying with some people, we use that as a justification for a rash action, often war at the international level?
So empathy is often used when we want to motivate war or assault against other groups. History is full of examples of this, but a contemporary example is in America today regarding undocumented immigrants and Muslims, where when people want you to hate those groups, they won't necessarily just say bad things about them. What they'll do is they'll tell you a story. And the story will be about the suffering of some innocent victim, someone who's assaulted or raped, or somebody who lost their job. And they'll use your empathy for these suffering people to catalyze your hatred and anger against the people who made them suffer. And there's laboratory evidence suggesting that people who are high in empathy are more punitive and more aggressive. Their empathy for the suffering of somebody motivates aggressiveness towards those who cause the suffering.
And you mentioned earlier that this kind of empathy, we're more prone to give it to people who are like us in some way, speak the same language, look similar, that sort of thing. I think back, and hopefully we're not going back here, but to the 1930s, when in Germany you could say, look at the suffering of our fellow Germans in under Czech rule or Polish rule. And you point out somewhere, look at the suffering that Germans are feeling, and a made-up example there, but at the hands of Jews, Germans would say then. This is something you worry about with empathy.
I worry a lot about it, and that's a terrific example. Some people think the Nazis were unempathic people, but they're profoundly empathic towards their own, and that's how empathy works. These feelings of empathy focus on the in-group, and they focus on the people you care about. There's a lot of neuroscience studies looking at how empathy lights up the brain, and it lights up the brain powerfully for people who are your friends, who have the same skin color as you, who are attractive, who are safe, and it doesn't light up at all for people who are your enemies, who are disgusting, who you're afraid of. To the extent we recognize that people in another country value, their lives have value, to the extent we recognize that whether or not someone is attractive or disgusting shouldn't matter in how you treat them, that's when we transcend empathy. We have broader issues, notions of human rights, broader notions of moral principles.
Is the answer to downplay the role of empathy, or is it to try to widen the umbrella of our empathy, to be, you know, go to the biblical example of the Good Samaritan and, you know, recognize suffering in any human, even one who might despise us?
So, in some way, if we were different kinds of creatures, we could feel empathy for everybody. The Israeli could feel as much empathy for the Palestinian as for the fellow Israeli. I could feel as much empathy for somebody in Africa as for my child. But empathy doesn't work that way. It's in some way as if, you know, we could change. We can't change what foods make us hungry. We can't change our sexual desires. We have limited scope in that. And I think empathy is inherently biased. It is impossible for me to feel closer to a stranger than to my son. But fortunately, we have moral reasoning and moral capacities mixed in with a sort of generalized kindness and compassion that can override the limitations of empathy.
Talking to Paul Bloom, his new book is Against Empathy, The Case for Rational Compassion. And Paul, I want to get into that rational compassion in a few minutes. Want to spend some time on another possible downside of relying on empathy that you talk about, and that's how we practice philanthropy, how we give money, how we make charitable decisions. How does empathy steer us wrong?
So empathy makes us vulnerable to appeals of cute babies and the chance of immediately alleviating suffering. But in the real world, often it's complicated to know what the right thing to do is. And often acting on empathy pushes you in a different direction than acting with a desire to make things better. One example I use in my book is the Newtown Massacre, which is after all these murders in Sandy Hook. People sent tons of plush toys, teddy bears and things, to Newtown, Connecticut. And then the people in Newtown said, stop. We have enough. We are now spending a lot of money and people to store all this crap you're sending us. And the weird thing, it's always been weird to me, is some people refuse to stop. Some people insist on sending canned foods to disaster areas, even when they say that these are causing a health problem because they already have enough. And I think the people who refuse to stop are scratching the empathic itch. They're feeling good about it. But what we really should do is try to make the world a better place, not to try to feel good about our actions.
And let's talk about scratching that itch. You've mentioned already that this urge to empathy, it's coming from our brains. It's part of how our brains work to a greater or lesser extent, depending on who we are. What is empathy doing in our brains?
Well, empathy, the study of empathy is fascinating. What happens is we can literally feel the pain of other people, feel their experiences. There's all these elegant experiments that, you know, they shock me and part of my brain lights up. Then I look at you while you're being shocked. And if I like you, if you look like me, and I feel empathy towards you, the very same parts of my brain that would light up when I'm shocked light up when you're shocked. And in some sense, you know, Bill Clinton's famous line, "I feel your pain," is literally true. We literally feel the pain of other people.
But you're hoping to switch now from relying on that kind of empathy, that feeling other people's pain, to something you're calling rational compassion. What is that?
So it's two parts. The rational part is kind of what it says, which is we should try to make the world a better place by thinking hard about the ramifications of our actions. Not focusing on what feels good and gives us a rush, but really, in the case of philanthropy, for instance, doing research on what charities make a real difference, as opposed to giving to the ones that have the most moving pictures. The compassion part is that it's long been known that sheer intelligence, sheer reason, isn't enough. You need some sort of motivation. But this motivation could be caring about other people without feeling their pain. And this has another advantage. There's been some wonderful studies, some of them looking at meditation and neuroscience, that find that we are far more likely to help and help with joy if we don't feel another person's pain, but instead simply feel loving and kindness towards them.
You've looked at doctor-patient relationships as well and empathy, and there's the thought a doctor should be empathic and feel their patient's pain. Patients want that kind of empathy or sympathy from a doctor. That doesn't necessarily help them, does it?
So that's a good example. So, you know, there's all these programs teaching doctors empathy, and if you realize what they mean, they often just mean doctors should be attentive and understanding and kind, and I'm all for that. But what about literal empathy? Well, think about what you want when you see a doctor or a therapist. Imagine you're feeling anxious and depressed. Do you want your doctor or therapist to feel anxious or depressed? Do you want them to feel your suffering and share your suffering? I don't think so. What you want is for them to understand you and for them to want to help you and deal with you with respect. But typically what we want when we're anxious isn't to deal with a doctor or therapist who's also anxious, but to deal with somebody who's calm. Just as with friends, when you're with a friend and you're depressed, you don't want your friend to be depressed. You don't want emotional empathy. You want your friend to understand you and care about you and then try to make you feel better.
Paul Bloom is with us. He's a psychology professor at Yale University. We're talking about his new book. It's called Against Empathy, The Case for Rational Compassion. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. What do you think about this idea? Maybe we put too much stock in the idea of empathy, of feeling and commiserating with each other's pain. Maybe we need a more rational approach when we're making charitable decisions, when we're helping friends or patients for that matter. Can empathy do more harm than good? Call 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're picking up our conversation now with Paul Bloom. He's a professor of psychology at Yale University. He's author of the new book, Against Empathy, The Case for Rational Compassion. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Tell us if you are or aren't a strong believer in empathy. Should empathy guide our moral decisions, or can that steer us wrong, as our guest says? We need to have a little more reason, but still compassion in the equation. What questions do you have for our guest along the way? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Paul, empathy, as you were saying, kind of comes from our brains. It's part of our humanity to a greater or lesser extent. How about this rational compassion? Where does that come from? How do we cultivate it?
It also comes from our brains. We're complicated creatures, and we have all sorts of moral motivations. How we cultivate it is interesting. The analogy I often give is with racism. So racism is like empathy in that it's kind of natural. We naturally favor a group over others, and it could dominate our moral decisions, and it's hard to resist its pull. But we're not limited by it. If I believe I have a racist bias and I don't want to, I could work hard to avoid it. I could focus on other things. I could try to orchestrate the world so that my bias can't apply. I could certainly refrain from using racist appeals to other people. And I think we could do the same thing with empathy. I think all of these capacities come from our brain, rationality, compassion, empathy, and we could work to privilege some over others.
We heard from Jim on Facebook. Jim writes, it seems to me that it would be desirable to put oneself in another's shoes and to consider the long-term consequences of a person's actions. It isn't an either-or proposition. Do you think Jim is onto something there, Paul?
I think he definitely is. But so long as what he means by put yourself in another person's shoes is understand them. I mean, look, I'm a parent. Suppose my teenage son is really, really upset and panicky because he hasn't done his homework and everything. It's, as a parent, I want to understand him. I want to understand where he's coming from and everything. But I think it does no good at all for me to put myself in the shoes in the sense of panicking along with him. You know, good parents are calm when their kids are freaking out, are reassuring when their kids are sad, and so on. So putting yourself in somebody's shoes makes sense in a sort of cognitive sense, but not in an emotional sense.
Let's go to our callers now. Dakota is on the line in Lamira. Dakota, hi.
Hello.
What did you want to tell us about?
Well, I'm kind of, okay, my entire life I've been interested in psychology and the human body and just a lot of things, but I've noticed as being an EMT and paramedic and stuff like that, I was a lot younger, my empathy was just skyrocketed. I wanted to help people, I felt what other people felt, and as I'm growing older and as I'm helping more and more people, I feel that decreasing significantly. And I'm worried about it because I'm like, well, what kind of caregiver am I? If my empathy isn't there, I mean, obviously I still feel empathy for people, but not, I want to make them feel better. I don't want to make them, I don't want to feel what they feel.
Dakota, I want to ask, as you don't feel what they feel, are you still doing the job they need you to do?
Yes.
And did you ever feel like maybe you were risking burning out if you were too empathetic earlier in your career?
There was actually a point that I was pretty close to burning out, and I think that's where I turned around, where I stopped being so empathetic.
Dakota, thank you so much for sharing that story. And Paul, I don't think Dakota is alone in this. I mean, if we're talking about healthcare providers, first responders, teachers, social workers, this has got to be a pretty common conflict, isn't it?
I think so, too. I love Dakota's remark, and I've been getting a lot of this by email and by letters from people who appreciate, you know, you may not agree with me about my whole argument, but I appreciate the distinction between empathy and compassion because it allows you to put your finger on something, which is that you can be a good and kind person, helping people, devoting your life to helping people, but also if you feel their pain too much, you will not be good at your job, and you will suffer along with them, and you will burn out. And certainly people who are highly empathic are at high risk for burnout. The people, I think, who make the best first responders, the best doctors, the best cops, and so on, are people who care about other people, but they aren't high empathy. They're actually pretty low empathy, at least with regard to their interactions. That's what enables them to be so effective.
You shared somewhere an example from the world of Buddhism on this issue. Can you talk about that?
So there's a lot of interest in mindfulness meditation, and the question is why, you know, there's all the benefits, but one recent benefit is it tends to make people kinder. There's some really cool laboratory studies suggesting that. And nobody knows exactly why, but one theory that investigators have is it makes you kinder because it lets you care for others, but you don't absorb their suffering. It makes you kinder because it ramps up compassion, but tampens down empathy. And that also, in some ways, is kind of an answer to something you had raised earlier, which is what can we do? And meditative practices are one way in which people who, I think, suffer from high empathy and as such aren't as good as they want to be in this world can work on that issue.
Dakota, thanks a lot for sharing your experience. We're talking to Paul Bloom. He's the author of the new book, Against Empathy, The Case for Rational Compassion. Back to our callers now. Jane is with us in Ashland County. Jane, hi.
Hi. I don't know how does the author feel about war. I don't believe anybody has the right to kill anybody, including themselves or people gestating in their mother's womb. Anybody at all, do not kill. Stop killing.
So my own view is I'm actually not a pacifist. I think some wars are justified. Sometimes you need to engage in war, kill people, even kill innocent people for a greater good. I think American intervention, World War II, was right. But I would agree with you that empathy, I think, makes us much more likely to favor war. because empathy fuels our desire for revenge, fuels our concern for other people. And the costs of war, which are people dying in the future, the enemy dying, statistical costs of battle, we're insensitive to. Our emotions don't resonate to it. So as we build up to war, empathy and other feelings are strong, and they often favor war. I think when we start thinking in terms of more cold-blooded cost-benefit analysis mixed with compassion, we become a lot more peaceful.
Thanks a lot for the call, Jane. I am reminded of a quote I think attributed to Stalin, something like, one death is a tragedy, a million deaths is a statistic. Is this partly retraining our minds not to be lured in by the tragedy of the one and try to view the tragedy of the million?
It's exactly what it is. You know, we are a species and we are a people who will become incredibly upset about a little girl stuck in a well or a lost teenager or some specific crime that catches our attention and obsesses us. Well, at the same time, we say, oh, let's do, you know, a bombing attack on this place. Hundreds, thousands will die. Well, you know, there's no specific person I know, nobody I could think of. It's all statistical. And that's when we reflect on it, not a good way to think about. I think in general it's because of a focus on empathy that we tend to ignore broader crises like global warming, international terrorism, focusing on immediate problems that objectively don't matter as much.
Does empathy as a tool, as compared to the rational compassion you're talking about, are we more subject to being manipulated if we're relying on empathy?
Very much. Every politician on the left and on the right, when they want to convince us to follow their cause, will drag out some schnook and say, you know, feel for this person. If they don't like Obamacare, they'll tell some story about somebody who suffered from Obamacare. If they like Obamacare, they'll tell some story of someone whose life will be ruined if you cancel it. And it's easy to do this because any large-scale policy will have its winners and losers. So you could always drag out somebody to feel empathic for. But intellectually, it's a terrible argument. It's and you're certainly right that empathy is exploited, sometimes ruthlessly, by politicians and demagogues of all sorts.
As we start to wrap up, Paul, you've been thinking about this, obviously, for some time, writing about it. Does this change the way you think about the news, about your daily life?
It does. I you know, like everybody, I try to be a good person, a good parent, a good friend, a good citizen. And thinking about empathy and its limitations has sort of forced me to rethink certain things. In part, I wrote the book because I'm very vulnerable to empathy myself. And I have now, I think, a better sense of where it's leading me astray and what I could do to stop this.
And what do you think about raising kids, teaching kids not that walk a mile in their shoes, feel other people's pain, but trying to educate them in rational compassion?
I think that's a wonderful way to go. I think one of the things you want to teach kids, which is absolutely important, is to say, you see these people in the future or these people in this faraway land or these people who scare you and so on, maybe you're not going to put yourself in their shoes. Maybe you're not going to feel their pain. It's very hard. But you should appreciate that their lives have value, too. Thinking in terms of human rights, in terms of making the world a better place, in terms of moral principles, leads to a much better moral view than simply saying, you know, listen to your heart, follow your gut.
We'll leave it there for now. Paul, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me on.
We've been talking to Paul Bloom. He's the Brooks and Suzanne Reagan Professor of Psychology at Yale University. Been talking about his new book. It's called Against Empathy, The Case for Rational Compassion. We have a link to an article excerpted from that book over at the Central Time Facebook page, and still time for you to head over there and share your thoughts. Has this conversation changed the way you think about the ideas of empathy and compassion, about charitable giving? Again, head over to the Central Time Facebook page, do some reading there, and as always, you can share your thoughts. Last week, we talked about the links between food and memory and invited you to share some of your cherished food memories, the flavors that take you back to another time or place. A lot of you called in with your stories, and then we heard a lot on social media, too. So here's a sampling of what you had to say on Facebook. Judy tells us the favorite food memory of my childhood at Christmas time was my mother's homemade nut roll. A slice of nut roll with some butter on it and a slice of Christmas ham on it. So good. I've got to admit, the nut roll is not part of my family tradition. I looked up. There's a lot of recipes out there. They look pretty good. Walnut heavy, the ones I saw. I don't know if I could get into that. But again, it's the particular memory that's important here. Speaking of walnuts, Julianne says my family celebrates with the traditional Hungarian sausages, poppy seed and walnut strudels, and the most amazing vanilla kipfel. That's one I did not get a chance to look up. I've got to figure out what a kipfel is. But vanilla, I assume it's a dessert of some sort. Brian says our neighbor when I was a kid had date pinwheel cookies, and the recipe said they keep well if you hide them. And Heather writes, every time I eat a simple red raspberry, I'm transported to childhood, walking the rows of berries and picking whatever I wanted to eat when I was hungry. I'd watch the bees and carefully walk around them. The raspberry rows buzzed with activity. She got literary there a little bit. Thank you all so much. You can keep sharing your thoughts, your food memories at the Central Time Facebook page. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.